Welcome to the CSIS Cogitasia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on policy in Asia. I'm your host, Colm Quinn. We'll start with the region's news. In China, a cruise ship capsized during a severe thunderstorm on the Yangtze River, trapping more than 400 people on board. 14 survivors abandoned the vessel called the Eastern Star, and a further 19 victims were pulled from the vessel or water by divers. Many of the passengers were elderly tourists sightseeing on a cruise from Nanjing to Chongqing. In South Korea, classes were cancelled and pandemic response mechanisms have been activated as more than 1,300 people were quarantined who may have been exposed to the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS. The outbreak began when a Korean man returned from Brunei in mid-May and came down with symptoms of the disease. At least 30 people had contracted the virus in Korea as of Wednesday, with two deaths. According to the World Health Organization, there is currently no vaccine or cure for MERS. In Singapore, US Secretary of Defense Ash Carter announced a new maritime security initiative for Southeast Asia at the annual Shangri-La Dialogue, the meeting of Asia's top defense officials. While details of the initiative were not announced, Carter did confirm that the US Congress has set aside $425 million to fund the effort. In Tokyo, the Japanese government decided on its commitment to reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 26% by 2030 from 2013 levels, as part of efforts to reach a new international agreement by the end of the year to address climate change. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe reportedly intends to explain the emission goal at the upcoming summit of the G7 starting Sunday in Germany and submit it to the United Nations in July. The Shangri-La dialogue dominated the stories in Asia this week, with much of the focus on China's land reclamation activities in the South China Sea and how the United States and ASEAN countries would respond. CSS Senior Advisor of Asia, Bonnie Glazer, attended the dialogue in person in Singapore and sat down with me upon her return. So Bonnie, you're literally just back from the Shangri-La dialogues. What were the big themes that were coming out?
The biggest theme this year was the South China Sea. And of course, this wasn't the first year that the discussions really focused on Chinese activities in the South China Sea. In 2012, after there was the standoff between China and the Philippines at Scarborough Shoal, that was the focus in the Shangri-La dialogue. And last year, when China deployed an oil rig in Vietnam's exclusive economic zone, that was once again really the focus of the discussions at Shangri-La. This year it was really China's land reclamation activities, building artificial islands, and the uncertainty and unpredictability that that has caused. And so virtually every speaker, every defense representative, not only from the Asia-Pacific region, but also from Europe, expressed concern about these reclamation activities and really underscored the need for a rules-based system in the Asia-Pacific and particularly in the waters around China, and called for adherence to international law, greater transparency, and really called for China to just get along better with its neighbors and not use coercive means against them.
And is there something new that needs to be put in place to achieve this rules-based system, or is it just a better adherence to the rules we currently have?
Well, international law has some gray areas in this regard, and the Chinese interpretation of the UN Convention, the Law of the Sea, is somewhat different than the United States. But there are questions about if you create an artificial island that was once a submerged rock, completely underwater all year round, according to UNCLOS, then there is no maritime zone that the country is entitled to, regardless of how big that artificial island becomes. But if that original rock was above water, at maybe low tide, then it might be entitled to a 12-mile territorial sea. But the Chinese aren't making clear exactly what they are claiming. So in the run-up to the Shangri-La dialogue, the United States started to weigh the possibility of conducting freedom of navigation patrols inside the 12 nautical mile zone around some of these artificial islands. Now, that has not yet taken place, but it is very much under consideration. And so this was really the backdrop at the Shangri-La dialogue. What will the U.S. do next to try and convince China to not do anything that will be seen by other countries as provocative? So Secretary of Defense Ash Carter made two very specific proposals. One was that all of the claimants in the South China Sea halt the land reclamation process. And the second proposal was that no further militarization of these islands take place. Now, most of the other claimants have militarized some of their artificial islands. Vietnam has some gun emplacements on at least one of their islands. There was a report that China had some artillery batteries that were emplaced on Fiery Cross Reef, but then they seemed to have disappeared, and nobody is certain whether they had been removed or just hidden. So if there is artillery, that could pose a threat to Vietnam's land feature, which is probably less than 12 nautical miles away. It's quite close. And so there's a distinction to be made between what some of these claimants like Vietnam and Malaysia have done. That is, had they have defensive, very small weapons that are placed just to defend against for the personnel that live there and very small structures, and the potential for offensive power projection capability. With the Chinese now putting in a very long airstrip at Fiery Cross Reef, which is probably more than 3,000 meters, that will be able to allow any aircraft in China's inventory to land on Fiery Cross. And potentially, people are worried that China might try to declare an air defense identification zone similar to the one that they established in the East China Sea in November 2013. So there's really a lot of uncertainty and anxiety. There's been discussion between China and ASEAN about the possibility of a binding code of conduct. And this has been going on for more than a decade. And there's really been glacial progress. And once again, at the Shangri-La dialogue, virtually every speaker called for progress in the near term, as soon as possible, on a code of conduct. But that seems very unlikely. And so diplomacy isn't really working. And I think the United States feels that to back up diplomacy, there needs to be an assertion of the right of freedom of navigation and freedom of flight near, even over, some of these artificial islands if they're not entitled to any maritime zone under the convention and the law of the sea.
And we talked about Carter's comments just there, and I do want to get back to that. But I want to get back to the dialogues itself. When you were there, what was the mood like towards the U.S.? There's obviously people coming from all parts of the world, experts and representatives, to discuss these issues. Do you think it was the U.S. needs to do more, the U.S. needs to do less? What was your take?
Well, I think coming into this meeting, there were expectations that the United States would be quite critical of China. I think some countries actually worried that the United States might be too harsh on China. Members of ASEAN often want the United States to get tough, but they don't want too much tension between the U.S. and China. It's like a Goldilocks solution. You know, they don't want us to be too friendly with China or be too critical of China. And so this year, I think the reaction of virtually everybody in the room was that Secretary Carter got it exactly right. He emphasized the need for a good military-to-military relationship between the U.S. and China. He talked about building habits of cooperation. But he called out China for its actions in the South China Sea. Where necessary, he was even-handed in noting that China's not the only claimant in the South China Sea that is building these artificial islands. The others did so long ago, and what China has done is far bigger in scope, and he made that point. But he also said that the real danger to stability is this militarization. And he called on all of the countries not to further militarize the islands. So he did call out China by name, but he was balanced. And even the Chinese, I think, thought that he was quite balanced in his speech. So I think he got it right in striking that balance between not being too confrontational, which would cause a great deal of unease in the members of ASEAN, and yet trying to signal China that it was posing a threat in a way that the United States is not going to tolerate.
Right, and I want to talk about Carter again and his announcement of this Maritime Security Initiative, not to be confused with CSS's Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative. This one's a little different. It's $425 million for partner countries to support them in this area. What can that support do, and what should it be doing?
Well, I think to some extent this new initiative is putting a title on something that is already underway. So the United States for the last few years has been trying to build capacity, particularly in the Philippines, also to some extent in Vietnam, so that these countries will have what we call greater maritime awareness, maritime domain awareness, so that they will know what is happening inside their 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone, both in the air and on the sea. The Philippines in particular needs this capability. Up until recently, it has had virtually no Coast Guard whatsoever. And the United States is not the only country that's assisting. Japan is going to supply 10 Coast Guard vessels to the Philippines. Australia is also stepping up. This money can be used to help the United States conduct more exercises with some of these countries so that they will be able to more effectively operate within their waters. Also supply perhaps some aircraft, maybe P-3s, so that they can fly over their maritime zone and see what is going on. If countries have a better capability, better eyes and ears, so that they can defend their EEZ, this might deter some of China's coercive actions in the region. So it's not intended to be provocative. It is intended to be defensive.
And finally, I want to talk about China. And obviously, China was under a lot of pressure and came under a lot of derision, I suppose, at this dialogue. Is there anything that China could have done better or can do better going forward to perhaps ameliorate the situation or at least make a better case for what they're doing?
This is my ninth time attending the Shangri-La Dialogue, and I have seen many defense representatives from China giving speeches and trying to answer questions. Virtually every year, the Chinese send somebody who has never attended the Shangri-La Dialogue before, and most of their senior PLA officers have very limited experience in the international community. The last thing that they want to do is make a mistake. And they're talking in large part to their domestic audience back home. So they want to be tough. They don't want to be seen as compromising, and they don't want to make a mistake. So this year, there was an admiral who's a three-star named Sun Jianguo, who was representing China. And his speech, I think, was not bad. It was a representation of China's policy, its interest. It underscored the fact that the Chinese want to use these islands in part for civilian purposes, for humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. If there were to be a disaster like MH370, they want to have capabilities where they could help to rescue people who might be in the water if there's an accident, or to conduct a search for a missing aircraft. So in that regard, the speech itself, I think, was good. But the problem was that Admiral Sun felt that he didn't have enough confidence to engage in questions. So he had a fat briefing book in front of him that had lots of tabs. So when the questions were taken, and there were at least one dozen questions that were posed to him, he simply listened to the questions, and if he heard the word Korea, there was a question, for example, about Korea's recent SLBM launch, and so he looked up in his briefing book, he found the Korea tab, and he read some sentence about how China supports peace and stability and denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula. So there was quite a gap between the question and the answer. There wasn't a single extemporaneous answer that he gave. And I think that that results in people having even more anxiety about China's intentions. There seems to be this unwillingness to respond to the concerns of the region. So I don't think it came across very effectively. The Chinese will have a hard time explaining what they're doing in the South China Sea in any case. They are not making a case in terms of international law. They are simply saying that they have sovereignty over these features. They're not saying what their rights are in the sea. And the Chinese have this very expansive claim, often referred to as the nine-dash line, which occupies, you know, somewhere between 60 and 90% of the South China Sea, depending on how you measure the size of the South China Sea. But they are deliberately ambiguous about what that claim entitles them to. Some people say it's jurisdiction over the waters, not sovereignty over all of the waters. And one of the really consistent themes of the Shangri-La dialogue was the need for China to clarify this potentially very, very vast claim. So far, I think the Chinese continue to believe that ambiguity serves their interests. And that's unfortunate, because I believe that the ambiguity is really one of the main sources of tensions in the South China Sea today.
Well, something we have to keep an eye on. Bonnie Glaser, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that was Bonnie Glaser. Now we turn to our one to watch for this week. It's no secret to watchers of world affairs that India and Pakistan have difficult relations. Accusations of spying and saber-rattling take place on a regular basis. However, that mistrust reached farcical levels this week as Indian authorities detained a pigeon on charges of spying for Pakistan. Reportedly, the bird was spotted by a boy living close to the border in the Indian village of Manwal, carrying a message. When examined, the message was written in Urdu, Pakistan's official language. The bird was x-rayed and logged as a suspected spy by Indian authorities, but no evidence suggesting foul play was found. The incident turned into one of amusement on both sides, and soon Pakistani social media users and internet-savvy citizens began to release memes and jokes teasing their neighbours over the pigeon's espionage. The phrases "pigeon versus India" and "if I were a pigeon" were mentioned thousands of times on Twitter, with users lampooning India's police, as well as Pakistan's own military and intelligence services. And that's our show for this week. You can always find more at cogitasia.com and csis.org. Also, check out our island tracker and maritime-specific analysis on the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative, or AMTI, microsite. I'm Colm Quinn. Thanks for listening.